It is still very easy to judge the age of a printed world map or globe. Just look to see if there are two Germanys. If there are, the map is older than 1990. It was in the fall of 1989 that the symbol of division between the two Germanys, the symbol of the Cold War between the United States and the states of Soviet communism, opened. Where once people were shot trying to breach the Berlin Wall, instead they stood on it, chipped pieces off it, and ultimately walked through it. Today's guest tracked the many pieces and players who led to the destruction of the Berlin Wall in her book, The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. Mary Elise Cerati splits her time between Boston and Los Angeles. She teaches government and history at Harvard and history at the University of Southern California. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a former White House fellow. And Mary Elise, I understand that this just won a 2014 Book of the Year from the Financial Times. So congratulations.
Yes, it did. I'm very, very pleased about that.
So interesting notes you have for us up front in the book. We called them East and West Germany. They obviously did not. What were the standard terms that were used by much of the rest of the world?
Right. This is seems like it's a minor difference, a minor technical point about language, but actually it's not. The West, what we call the West Germans, meaning the Germans living in the western half of the state, refer to themselves as the Federal Republic of Germany. And the East Germans, people living in the Soviet bloc, refer to themselves as the German Democratic Republic, or at least the leaders of the regime did. It was not actually democratic. The elections were fraudulent, but it was important to the regime for PR purposes to call itself the German Democratic Republic. And so the terms that we use, East and West Germany, those are artifacts of English. The German Democratic Republic kept insisting that it represented, you know, all of Germany, the best of Germany, and the Federal Republic did not want to acknowledge the division as permanent, so they both avoided those names. So that was a little bit of a challenge, writing in English about a book where a lot of the original material was in German.
All right, hence the references in the book to FRG and GDR,
because
right, that's the way they looked at it. Was that name, German Democratic Republic, a thumb in the eye of the West?
It was an attempt to thumb the West in the eye, but it backfired, particularly in 1989. The elections, as I said, were fraudulent. The ruling regime won over 99% of the vote. The only mystery was whether it would be 99.98 or 99.97% of the vote. There was a joke that there had been a crime at the election results office, and the results for the next 10 years had been stolen, so they would have to rewrite them. So because the elections themselves were fraudulent, and the regime called itself the German Democratic Republic, it opened itself up to a lot of criticism. And in 1989, after Mikhail Gorbachev had come to power in the Soviet Union and had opened the door for at least partially free elections, the people of East Germany called their leaders on the carpet, and there were a lot of protests in May of 1989 after another one of these fraudulent elections took place. Instead of in the past simply suppressing dissent, there was such outcry about it that it really caused the regime a lot of trouble.
I want to talk first about the significance of the wall itself, because granted, a lot of people listen to public radio are old enough to remember a lot of this, but then I want to bring younger people in here, too. The significance of the wall dividing East and West Berlin within, actually, the German Democratic Republic, this was a life-and-death situation if you tried to go over the wall.
Yes, it was. And just on a personal note, I actually was doing study abroad in West Berlin when I was much younger, in the year of 1989. And because I was living in West Berlin in 1989, that's how I got interested in this subject and indeed in being a professional historian, full stop. So this was the year that changed my life as well. It was, as you say, a very unusual spectacle. The city of Berlin was inside East Germany. It was not on the border between the two Germanys. And so when the city of Berlin became divided, when the wall went up, it actually created an island inside East Germany. In fact, this is a great historical trivia point. The city of West Berlin was the only city with an outline traced in lights and visible from outer space, because the entire wall was, of course, illuminated during any hours of darkness, and the wall enclosed the entire city of West Berlin. And the wall was was sometimes also known as the Death Strip. It was not just one wall. It was multiple walls. It included mines. It included self-firing machine guns that would be tripped if someone tried to sneak by. It included dog runs. And one of the saddest discoveries in my research was just how badly the dogs were abused, who were used in those dog runs, by the way. So there was a very brutal barrier between West Berlin and the rest of East Germany, just as there was an armed barrier, of course, between East Germany proper, or the German Democratic Republic, and West Germany, or the Federal Republic of Germany.
Which raises the question about outside of Berlin itself. I mean, in the barrier between the East and West Germany, was it as comprehensive as the wall?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It was just a little different because much of the boundary between East and West Germany ran through countryside. The barrier both between East and West Berlin and then between West Berlin and the rest of East Germany, remember, of course, West Berlin is an island inside East Germany, so it's got a circular wall all the way around it. That wall was much closer to human habitation, to apartment buildings. And because the East German regime was very concerned with its appearance, it actually hesitated in some places where the wall went very close to buildings to use some of its more gruesome devices. So, for example, I describe in my book, The Collapse, how on the border between the two Germanies, there were truly awful self-triggering devices. It's hard to describe them, but basically they would shoot hundreds of metal projectiles intended to basically, you know, just kill someone by puncturing them hundreds and hundreds of times with these very sharp steel projectiles, and they were incredibly gruesome. They went in, the East German regime installed them on the border between East and West Germany, but they intentionally refrained from installing them on the border between East and West Berlin, because since the wall went through the middle of the city, it would have been easier to see them in action and to photograph their gruesome consequences. So there were some differences such as that, but they were both highly controlled borders. It was only at the risk to your own life that you could try to cross either of them, whether it was the border between the two Germanies or the border between the two Berlins. It's not as if there were holes in the border between the two Germanies and no holes in the Berlin Wall. They were both sealed borders.
Which is a great place to remember that, that's what made the significance of the wall coming down so great, is that this was something that you would die if you tried to get over before. And here were people standing on top of it in November of 1989. How and why they got there and the sequence of events and people and decisions, and in some cases non-decisions that led to that, all the focus of Mary Elise Cerati's book, The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. We'll come back and talk more with Mary Elise and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Mary Elise Cerati, a professional historian and the author of a book about what exactly happened that led to the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989. November 1989, people stood atop the wall, began chipping away at it. Suddenly, people could move between the two Germanies for the first time since the 1940s. The book is called The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Mary Elise, how tricky was it for you to weed out the myths from the facts about why the wall came down? It seems like there were lots of both.
Yes, there was. That was one of the biggest challenges. The reason this book came about is that I actually wrote a previous book about the foreign policy conflict that followed the opening of the wall. What would happen once the Cold War order crumbled? Of course, power, like nature, abhors a vacuum, so there was a great deal of struggle to define post-Cold War Europe. So I wrote a book called 1989, The Struggle to Create Post-Cold War Europe. And the reason this book came about is that when I would go out to give talks about that previous book, I would often get up and say, hello, I'm here to talk to you about the foreign policy conflict that followed the accidental opening of the Berlin Wall. And often I would not even get through that sentence, and someone from the audience would stop me and say, wait a minute, what do you mean by the accidental opening of the wall? And sometimes I would get a more pointed question. Sometimes someone would interrupt me and say, wait a minute, don't you know that President Reagan opened the wall in 1987 when he went to the wall and said, tear down this wall? And that happened enough times that I realized the unbelievable accidental nature of the story just was not well known in the United States. And I tried to figure out why that was, and I thought, well, if I didn't speak German, if I didn't used to live in Germany, what would I read in English about this amazing story? And I pretty quickly realized that there wasn't a good book-length account summarizing it. There were some excellent memoir accounts, but there wasn't a good sort of summary of it. And so that was where I decided to take the book on, and realizing that there just wasn't an understanding of how important the locals were. So in the United States, we do understand the importance of the superpower conflict, and I'm in no way denying that significance. The struggle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union defined the second half of the 20th century. And when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power and announced that he was instituting reforms, it created the context in which the wall could open. But it did not actually open the wall. That actually happened because of the actions of locals. And that's really what my book is about. There's this saying that success has many fathers. And since the opening of the Berlin Wall, which is such a success, there's a lot of people who've claimed to be its fathers in the decades since. But what I'm trying to do in my book is to let the actual fathers and mothers of the events speak for themselves in their own voices, the people who in the short term actually brought down the wall.
The other part of that is success has many fathers and failure is an orphan, but no orphans here. Interesting, though, it sounds like what the response you were getting is akin to when President Reagan said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," that the response was, "Oh, okay."
Right. There's an assumption I countered again and again when I was giving talks about my previous book, that President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, since they had met at a number of summits, had somehow worked out a plan, and that the opening was a result of that plan. And nothing could be further from the truth. They were unable to reach any kind of agreement on Berlin, even though they did reach agreement on arms control and a number of other issues. And President Reagan left office. He, of course, had served two terms, and in January 1989 left office, and President George H.W. Bush took over. And President George H.W. Bush was much less interested in closeness or cooperation with Gorbachev than President Reagan had been, and instituted what has become known as the pause in U.S.-Soviet relations. He wanted to take time to settle in, to assess all of his options, and he was a little concerned about President Reagan working so closely with Mikhail Gorbachev. So President George H.W. Bush instituted this pause just as events on the ground in 1989 were heating up. And, of course, this is not just in Europe. This is also in China as well. Until the fall of 1989, the headline event, of course, was China, was the Tiananmen protest, an event we're, of course, recalling today quite often with everything going on in Hong Kong. And the Tiananmen protests, as many of your listeners will remember, did not end peacefully. They ended with the People's Liberation Army massacring the people on Tiananmen Square, in Tiananmen Square, a square in the heart of Beijing. To this day, we don't actually know how many of the students and other unarmed protesters there died, and many of them were imprisoned, if they not, were not wounded or killed. So that was a very tragic story in the summer of 1989, and that actually was very much on the minds of everyone in Eastern Europe in the fall of 1989. We, of course, now remember that the fall of 1989 in Eastern Europe ended peacefully, but the people on the ground at the time didn't know that. They, in fact, had images of Tiananmen Square in their mind.
Mary Elise Cerati, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. So in that same year, by early 1989, rumors abounded that guards were no longer shooting at the wall. But what, in fact, was going on?
Yes, there had been as I said before, the East German regime was odd because on the one hand, it wanted to control the movement of its own people, absolutely. But on the other hand, it wanted to present a friendly face to the world in order to obtain such goals as membership in the UN, which it did obtain, and financial help and support from West Germany. So the regime acted one way, but spoke differently in public. So, for example, the regime publicly denied that there was any order to shoot people trying to cross the border, even though there are approximately 1,700 shooting incidents aimed at people trying to cross the border. So there was a sort of built-in ambivalence between what the regime said and what it did. And it would sometimes, if a high-profile visitor were coming to town, sometimes quietly pass the word, "No, you really shouldn't shoot, because we don't want to be embarrassed while the world media is here for this high-profile visitor." But that was a very, that was something that would sort of happen behind closed doors. It was not like it was announced publicly, you know, "This weekend, no shooting." And so it would give rise to rumors. And that, unfortunately, led to the death of a particularly tragic death in February 1989 of a young 20-year-old man named Chris Geoffroy, who had heard a rumor that was false, that there would be no shooting at the border for a few days, and he tried to escape, and he was shot. And one of the most moving parts of my research was speaking to his mother, who was then tireless in her efforts afterward to find justice for her murdered son, to bring the people who had shot him to justice. It seemed like a hopeless quest, but of course then when the wall came down, she actually was able to bring the guards who had shot her son to trial in United Germany.
Wow. So there were obviously was a bit of an uproar about the shooting of Chris Geoffroy. And how did Erich Honecker, then the leader of East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, respond?
Well, it's important to differentiate between the response in West Germany and West Berlin versus in East Berlin and East Germany. There was no public uproar in East Berlin or in East Germany because the ruling regime controlled the media. So there was no opportunity for a public uproar. But the mother of the young man who was shot, again, his name was Chris Geoffroy, and her name is Karen Geoffroy, and I interviewed her as part of my research for my book, The Collapse. She was able to smuggle a picture of her son and other information about her son's killing to the West, where it was broadcast on Western television channels that could be received in East Berlin and in East Germany. So, again, this was part of her tireless effort to make the killing of her son known and to bring the killers of her son to justice. She, of course, suffered personally for this a great deal. She was subjected to months of interrogation and harassment by the East German secret police. But after weeks and weeks of this, the bad press in the West was enough that the leader of East Germany at the time, a man named Erich Honecker, reluctantly said, well, perhaps we should scale back on the violence at the border. Although even this was ambivalent because the head of the East German secret police, or Stasi, around the same time said things like, well, you know, if we're going to shoot people, we should just shoot them in a way that they don't get away, or in a way that, you know, no information gets out to the West. So even that was ambivalent. But after that killing, yes, there were no more deaths by gunfire at the wall, although guards still did fire at people into April. And the last death trying to escape East Germany as a whole actually took place just 10 days before the wall came down. So there was still a great deal of violence on the border right up until the end.
Mary Elise Cerati, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a historian and the author of the book The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. And the accidental makes some people chafe, but we'll get further into why she reaches this conclusion. Join us on the Exchange with your questions and comments, 800-838-3760, the phone number anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Was Honecker among the Eastern European leaders within the Soviet bloc the one who struggled the most with the Gorbachev reforms?
Yes, Erich Honecker and Mikhail Gorbachev did not like each other. Mikhail Gorbachev, in private, used language that I can't use on the radio to describe Erich Honecker. Mikhail Gorbachev felt that in order to save socialism, reforms were necessary. Erich Honecker felt exactly the opposite. And Erich Honecker found himself in a bind because for a long time, East Germany had emulated the Soviet Union in all ways possible. Indeed, there was a kind of a slogan that school children had to learn called learning. It roughly translated, it went, learning from the Soviet Union means learning how to be victorious. That slogan, of course, became a problem when the Soviet Union under Mikhail Gorbachev started to institute reforms. He came to power in 1985 and, as I said, introduced semi-free elections, some freedom of the press, and other changes. And this was anathema to Erich Honecker, the leader of the hardline East German regime. And he tried very much to seal East Germany off from those reforms. But that turned out to be self-defeating. When he actually sealed the borders of his own country in October 1989, it had the unintended effect of turning his own country into a pressure cooker. And there were huge protests, particularly in cities like Dresden and Leipzig in the south of former East Germany. And those protests eventually became overwhelming. They forced the regime into a retreat. So that tension that you mentioned between Erich Honecker and Mikhail Gorbachev was a very important part of the story of the fall of 1989.
What is it specifically about Leipzig and Dresden that made those cities have such a lot of influence in the events that led to the destruction of the wall?
Well, partly it's because those cities had the East German protest movement was small, but it had centers of activity in Dresden and Leipzig. and their dissidents had been active even, of course, before Mikhail Gorbachev had come to power. But then in the fall of 1989, the southern part of East Germany, a region historically known as Saxony, sees an unusual influx of people. The reason that happens is that to the south of East Germany, there is Czechoslovakia. At the time, that was one state, Czechoslovakia. And below that was Hungary. Now, these were all part of the Soviet bloc. But Hungary and the leaders of Hungary were, like Gorbachev, interested in reforms. And so in the spring and summer of 1989, the leaders of Hungary decided to put holes in the Iron Curtain. They decided to make it easier for Hungarians to travel from Hungary into neighboring Austria. Now, those changes were only meant to help Hungarians, but when East Germans, who lived under a much more oppressive regime, heard about those changes, they unexpectedly started rushing to Hungary to get out. And the Hungarian government was shocked. They didn't know what to do. They were overwhelmed with, at one point, they estimated 200,000 East Germans. And they gave in to the pressure and opened the border to East Germans as well as to Hungarians. And so for a brief while, East Germans could just flood out of Hungary. But the East German regime under Erich Honecker was, of course, horrified by this. And it then sealed the borders of East Germany, as I was mentioning before. And what happened is people were trying to head south through East Germany to get to Hungary, but they literally got stuck in the southern part of East Germany, in Saxony. And so the leaders of local dissident movements were able to seize on the frustration of these people who were stuck there and help to organize some very, very large protests, which the regime initially tried to crack down on with violence. But the violence also turned out to be self-defeating because the regime would use more violence and then more people would protest, and they would use more violence and then more people would protest. So it turned Saxony into a real cauldron of dissent.
Mary Elise Cerati, again, our guest on The Exchange. Her book, The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. The sheer size of the protests, particularly in Leipzig, it got to the point where nobody could really ignore them, clearly. And you mentioned already the parallels with Tiananmen Square having happened earlier that very same year. There were some moves, as you write in the book, about what the East Germans did to make sure that they weren't in a situation where people were afraid to fire on their fellow citizens. What was it they did with the stocking the ranks of the police to cover the protests?
Yes, the city of Leipzig, it turns out to be hugely important. In fact, if readers look at my book, they'll see that almost half of the book actually takes place in the East German city of Leipzig, not just in East Berlin. And I actually initially wanted to call the book A Tale of Two Cities, but my publisher pointed out that title was taken already, so I should probably find something else for it. But it is impossible to understand why the Berlin Wall came down without first understanding what happened 1 month earlier in the East German city of Leipzig. The wall comes down on November 9th, but 1 month earlier, on October 9th, these protests that I was just describing in Saxony come to a head. As I said, there was a protest, and the regime used violence, and then more people came out because they were horrified by the violence, and so the regime used more violence, and then more people came out, and so on and so on. And so it had been a vicious spiral. And by the night of October 9th, it was clear that it was a showdown. A showdown was coming. The diaries from people who were there that night all bear similar comments. They say things like, tonight is Tiananmen in Germany. Tonight is China in Germany. There'll be a Tiananmen Square-style event in Germany. And on the side of the security forces, records from that day show they were preparing for just such a crackdown. I was able to use local police records, East German secret police files, interviews, and the people on the ground say, yes, I received a gun, I received bullets, I was told to shoot, I was told it's us or them. Superior police officers received arms and weapons and reportedly told the junior officers, I'll use this bullet in the back of your head if you don't do your duty tonight. There was a lot of pressure placed on the security forces to crack down that night. And so the whole city was just gripped by fear. Foreign journalists were denied access to the city, and if they showed up anyway, were escorted by security forces out of the city. It was clear the regime wanted everybody out of the way to crack down definitively on the protest movement. And then two unexpected things happened. The first is that, despite this level of fear, at least 100,000 people showed up to protest. No one thought that was possible. So the sheer size of the crowds was overwhelming to the local forces. And the other second unexpected development was that there was a break in the ranks of the party leadership. The man on control on the ground in Leipzig was actually a last-minute substitute. He was actually a second party secretary. the man who was supposed to be on charge in charge on the ground and to lead the crackdown was supposed to be the first party secretary, who, if you can believe it, had called in sick that day. You can't make this stuff up.
No.
And so the second party secretary had to stand in for him. And the second party secretary got very suspicious. He thought he might be being set up, that he might actually, say, commit war crimes and then be persecuted afterwards. And so he got very nervous. And even though he did not need to do so, he called East Berlin. He called one of his superiors in East Berlin a few minutes before the crackdown was to start and said, you know, are we really going to do this to 100,000 people? And the superior in East Berlin said to him, I'll think about it and call you back. And the man in Leipzig couldn't believe that he was being left dangling on the end of the phone like that and began to get very anxious that he was being set up, especially when there was no return phone call. And so at the last possible minute, he felt just too worried about what might happen. At the last possible minute, he issued an order to retreat. So the combination of the size of the crowds and then this break in the ranks of the party leadership meant that the huge protest march actually went forward without any incident. And that was a huge success for the peaceful revolution that was developing in East Germany. It hugely increased popular confidence.
Major, major protest in Leipzig, Germany in October of 1989, leading in large part to the collapse, the accidental opening of the Berlin Wall that Mary Elise Cerati writes about in her book in November of 1989. We'll work between October and November when we get back to the exchange in just a few moments. You can join us as well with your questions or comments by phone or email. Back on the exchange with Mary Elise Cerati and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is the historian Mary Elise Cerati. She is telling the gripping story of how the Berlin Wall came down in November of 1989 and the events that led up to it, all detailed in her book, The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. You can join the discussion on the exchange, 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So this huge protest, 100,000 people in Leipzig, Germany, on October 9th, and the police do not fire on them. And you write that Erich Honecker, the leader of the German Democratic Republic, which we know as East Germany, was unhinged. What did he want to do?
Yes, he couldn't believe that the security forces had failed to crack down, and he wanted to escalate the level of violence and even began talking about an aerial assault, which, for your listeners who know the history of World War II and know about the firebombing of Dresden and of Saxony in World War II, know that would just have been a hugely tragic event with hugely tragic parallels to World War II. And Erich Honecker's unhinged reaction was too much even for his colleagues in the Politburo, which was the entity at the top of the ruling regime in East Germany. And as a result of his unhinged reaction to the successful protest march in Leipzig on October 9th, they actually organized a palace coup. They ousted him from within. The Politburo, led by a man named Egon Krenz, who had long been the number two in waiting, ousted Honecker and publicized that ouster on October 18th. And Egon Krenz, the new leader in East Germany, decided to try a new approach. He still wanted to maintain control, but he decided to talk a good game in public as a sop to the crowds to try to quiet the protest movement. Thanks to homemade videos in Leipzig on October 9th, homemade videos that were smuggled out to the West, Western broadcasters had learned about the success of the Leipzig protest movement and had broadcast images of it again to East Germany, and it had helped to fuel a wave of protests across the entire country, a wave that was now about to sweep over Berlin and crash up against the wall. And so Egon Krenz, his successor, seeing this wave coming, decided this new approach. He would talk a good game in public, but in private still maintain control over the movement of his people. The state still had to give permission for someone to leave, whether as an emigre forever or just for a cup of coffee in the West. And so it was on the fateful day of November 9th, 1989, the day that saw the accidental opening of the Berlin Wall, that Erich that Egon Krenz put this plan into effect. And what Egon Krenz did was to have a fellow member on the Politburo, a man named Günter Schabowski, present some travel law reforms. These were not meant to be far-reaching, but this Politburo member, Günter Schabowski, botched the announcement. He made it sound at a live international televised press conference as if these changes were significant. And before he even finished speaking, journalists, wire reporters, rushed out of the room and filed wire reports saying, the wall is open. And when this Politburo spokesman, Günter Schabowski, realized what was happening, he tried to backpedal, but it was too late. Journalists had already rushed out of the room and reported the wall was open. And so that started the dramatic sequence of events on the night of November 9th.
It was just a couple of words, wasn't it? Just like, and this applies to East and West Berlin as well, something like that?
Well, the actual wording of the text that he was supposed to announce was long and complicated, but he mumbled his way through it. It was almost impossible to understand him except for a few words. And the few words that did jump out clearly, such as possible to cross the border, possible for every East German, including West Berlin, those words that popped out sounded extremely promising. Indeed, they sounded so promising that journalists in the room, as I mentioned, specifically the wire reporters, under pressure to be the first to break what sounded like very bad news, rushed out. This press conference went from 6 to 7 p.m. on the night of November 9th, and already at 7.02 p.m., so only 120 seconds after the end of the press conference, the first wire services were reporting the wall is open. And those journalists had rushed out of the room even before the end of the press conference to get those reports out. So they had done so on the basis of the few words that they could hear. Günter Schabowski was, a member of the Politburo, and it turned out he was very, very bad at holding press conferences. That press release that he read, he didn't even bother to read it until he was live on air. I mean, it's not surprising if you remember, of course, that he was a member of a repressive regime.
Yeah, the whole idea of live news conferences themselves seems pretty alien to that culture.
Yes, exactly. And that was only under the pressure of these extraordinary protests in the fall of 1989, and it was part of this misbegotten, self-defeating attempt to talk a good game in public, present a happy face in public, but still try to maintain control behind the scenes. So yes, that holding that press conference turned out to be a very, very bad move for the East German ruling regime.
Wow. One more reason to read your press conferences, your news releases before you get to the microphone.
Yes.
Although in this case, it was a good thing for the world he didn't. Let's take a call. We're talking to Mary Elise Cerati, the author of The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. Here's Heidi in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I wanted to really thank Marie that she is correcting history. I was in Berlin in 1963 in August when the wall went up. It wasn't a wall, it was just barbed wire that was rolled across the streets wherever the most traffic was at the time. And I went back to Berlin in 89 to participate in the reunification ceremony, which was very festive and respectful, I have to say, and very moving. And it was then that I heard from my East German cousins what really happened, because I was, of course, subject here to the stories we were told, you know, that President Reagan has made it possible for the wall to come down. And history is always written by the victors, obviously, but I knew better, and I couldn't convince anybody that it wasn't so. So thank you so much for bringing the truth out.
All right. Thanks for the call, Heidi. Appreciate that. But, Mary, you get challenged on this a fair amount, it sounds like.
Yes, I do. And I just wanted to say thank you very much to Heidi for her kind words. It sounds like she knows quite a bit about this, if she was both in Berlin in August 1961 when the wall went up and again in 1989 when it went down. So great to hear from someone who was there. Yes, we tend to like to believe that great events have great causes, and that's not always the case. Sometimes great events don't have great causes. This Politburo member who messed up a press conference, it was as if he'd pushed a boulder from the top of a mountain, and it rolled down the mountain, creating ever greater destruction to the Cold War order, but he hadn't meant to do that. And the flip side is true as well. Just because events happen by accident doesn't mean they're unimportant. The opening of the Berlin Wall was hugely important. It's the hinge between the Cold War order and our present world order today. And that transition would not have happened in the way it did without this accidental sequence of events that I've been describing here. Mikhail Gorbachev had come to power, true, but he was interested in gradual reform, semi-free elections, power sharing. He was interested in a years-long, if not decades-long, process of transition. Similarly, inside the East German regime, there were opponents of the hardline leader who were thinking about a transition, but they were thinking about it in terms of, let's sell pieces of the wall to the West. Let's gradually open up access, but we'll get money for it from the West. There'll be a controlled transitional process. So the whole process would have looked completely different. Even though Mikhail Gorbachev was a reformer, he did not have give up Germany on his reform to-do list. The Soviet Union had shed an enormous amount of blood to repulse the Nazis and then to conquer the Nazis. Tens of millions of Soviet soldiers and citizens had died. And the Soviet Union, up to and including Mikhail Gorbachev, felt completely justified in holding on to occupy Germany. So giving up Germany was not on Mikhail Gorbachev's to-do list until this accidental opening of the wall forced him to deal with it, because he was literally asleep through the night while this was happening. Moscow was, of course, a number of hours ahead of East Berlin, and by the time he woke up, there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people flowing back and forth between the two halves of Berlin. It was a fait accompli. So the fact that this happens unexpectedly, the fact that it's not planned, even the fact that it happens in the middle of the night, is hugely significant. And the fact that the border guards on the wall don't shoot is hugely significant as well. That's another piece of the story that I describe in my book, how baffled the border guards were that night, because, of course, they had no instructions and were therefore shocked when the crowds of people showed up at the wall.
I didn't realize the heavy significance of the date, too. November 9th has quite a few ripples through German history, recent German history.
Yes, of course, yes. November 9th was the date of a number of significant events in German history. Perhaps most tragically, the so-called Kristallnacht, a pogrom against German Jews. And that is a date heavy with significance in German history, which lends even more sort of irony to the fact that the wall opens that day. Since there was no plan to open the wall, the East German regime did not plan to open the wall. The Soviet Union did not plan to open the wall. Since there was no plan to open the wall, there was, of course, no discussion of the date. Since there was no plan to fling wide the gates, no one said, hey, should we really do that on November 9th, given all of the other tragic associations with that date? But since that discussion never happened, it didn't come up. So it actually is a truly remarkable coincidence. It's also a remarkable coincidence that it happened in the 200th anniversary year of the French Revolution. That is another coincidence, but one that suggests we should consider the words of Tocqueville, that great political theorist. Tocqueville, of course, argued that the most dangerous time for a dictatorship is not a time of brutal repression, but rather a time of reform. Because when people who've been putting up with repression suddenly get a sense that that repression might have an end, that the intolerable grievances they've been living with might not have to be tolerated much longer, that's when they rise up. And that, I think, really encapsulates what is going on in East Germany.
Let's take a call. We have Jim and Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mary Elise Cerati. Her book is The Collapse.
Yeah, quick question. How often in discussion groups or classes does the comparison of the aftermath of the Civil War compare with, you know, the bringing down of the wall? Because there was cheap labor flowing to the other side, which caused some kind of hostilities, and people were able to reunite, oh, not only families, but fraternal organizations, religious organizations in Germany, gay organizations and everything. But and the question, has the average working man's wage equalized East-West, you know, over a generation?
All right, good questions all. Thanks, Jim.
Yes, that's a whole separate area, how the process of unification actually unfolded. You asked how often in the classroom I have students compare the aftermath of the U.S. Civil War with the aftermath of the fall of the wall. I have not actually had a student ask that specific question. But the broader issue of how unification unfolded and of the way in which it has disappointed many, not only East Germans, but also West Germans, is a huge topic in its own right and the subject of a number of books in its own right. The process of unifying Germany took place in just 329 days after the wall came down. So Germany unified formally and legally on October 3rd, 1990, which was just breathtakingly quickly. And indeed, if on the day before the wall had come down on November 8th, 1989, you had said to someone, oh, Germany will be unified on October 3rd, 1990, no one would have believed you. So it was a breathtaking series of events. It happened that quickly because after the wall came down, Chancellor Helmut Kohl of West Germany really put the pedal to the metal, really accelerated the unification process to get it done as quickly as possible because he was worried that Mikhail Gorbachev might fall from power, which he eventually did. The way that Chancellor Kohl put it is, we need to get our harvest in before the storm, the harvest being the process of unifying Germany, and the storm being some kind of event that would remove Mikhail Gorbachev from power. And there was, of course, a coup against Mikhail Gorbachev in 1991. The coup failed initially, but it did contribute to Gorbachev then losing power and indeed to the whole Soviet Union collapsing. So Helmut Kohl really rushed the process of unification, and which is understandable, but in that rush, a number of important issues related to some of the things you're talking about, such as wages and so forth, just simply had to be bracketed out, left aside, in a real drive to unify Germany, and with the consequence that then there were a number of unresolved issues in the months afterwards.
I'm struck by the fact that this was not a smooth curve of events, that I believe you have descriptions here of water cannons still being used on people at the wall 2 days after November 9th.
Because the East German regime did not intend to open the wall, and because the border guards had no orders to open the gates, that night when people started showing up at the wall, the border guards had to react in an ad hoc, uncoordinated fashion. And at some places, such as the Brandenburg Gate, the border officials used water cannon and other means to actually restore control. So if you had a time-lapse photo of that famous shot of the Berlin Wall standing in front of the Brandenburg Gate, there's a photo of it in my book, The Collapse, you'd see that there are sometimes people on it, but then at other times, the Eastern regime blows them away with water cannons. This was a close-run thing. It did not have to be peaceful, and so it's amazing it turned out as well as it did.
It really did, and it's an amazing story, well told, with lots and lots of research. The Collapse, the Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall, now just recently named a 2014 Book of the Year by the Financial Times. Mary Elise Cerati wrote it. She's been our guest. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.